Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Rahul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Rahul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, ELAWVATE.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net. And Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Gross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute. Welcome to the Elevate podcast. I'm Rahul Ravapudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul, I'm hoping you're getting ready to roll out the red carpet for me and Josie. We're heading out your way next week.
I can't wait to see you guys. And I'm so excited. Josie's, touring USC and UCLA, two of the most amazing Southern California campuses.
Yeah, and maybe your son can give us the tour of UCLA.
He'd love to. I think it's one of the prettiest campuses.
Yeah, I love UCLA. It's really terrific. And we're going over to Claremont McKenna too.
Oh, fantastic.
So we'll be buzzing around there, checking stuff out. How are the riots going? Do we have to worry about that at all?
You do not have to worry about it. I was in court on Monday, but I will say in downtown LA, and I did take some footage of the outside of my office building, and they cleaned it up really fast, but it's just like nonstop spray paint everywhere. And it was a little tough to see just because, you know how it must have looked when it was really packed. So there's a lot of anger and frustration in downtown, but it's now officially empty. I think it's so empty that no restaurants are actually getting occupied. I mean, it's actually a problem for the small businesses too.
Yeah. Well, I try to avoid downtown LA if I can anyway, so.
Unless you're going to a Laker game.
Yeah, no, I always try to get to a Laker game when I'm out there. Well, looking forward to the trip. So today we've got a kind of a different plan. We're just going to circle back and close up some loose ends from things we've talked about before. And one of them is your verdict in the jiu-jitsu case where you got the $56 million verdict or something to that effect. And that verdict actually caused major waves across the country. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me to talk to me about that verdict in your case, and they're just fascinated by it. In fact, I think I mentioned we just hired a new marketing director who is a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and he had a lot of questions about that and a lot of anger about the case and wanted to listen to your episode to understand it better. But since then, your verdict has been affirmed on appeal, which happened recently. Congratulations. And there's new breaking developments even as of yesterday. So why don't you tell us what's going on?
Yeah. So, you know, in California, after you get a judgment, which is what happens after the verdict, then you get post-judgment interest, and it goes at 10% per year. So the verdict was a little over $46 million, and then the insurance company decided to appeal the verdict, and then that got affirmed in a published opinion a little while ago. And then they decided to take it up to the California Supreme Court and seek review, and then that review was denied. And so then the judgment became final, and with interest, it became over $56 million, which they ultimately paid, because they posted a bond, which was required for a little over $70 million. And this case arose out of an open policy case. And what I mean by that is the jiu-jitsu club had a $1 million policy. And Jack Greener and his counsel, our co-counsel, served a policy limits demand and said, "You gravely injured me, but this is all the coverage you have, and we're giving you an opportunity to pay it." And when a demand like that happens in a case with exposure like this, from the plaintiff's perspective, we have some thoughts as to what's swirling around on the other side. But without bearing the lead, yesterday an article came out from Mr. Itaralde's perspective, who was the black belt instructor who broke my client's neck and rendered him an incomplete quadriplegic. And he lays out exactly what he was experiencing. And what I envision happening is that a lawyer for the defense and the insurance company needs to inform his clients, which include the insurance company and the defendants, "Hey, there's this demand for $1 million to settle the case, which is the insurance policy limits. What's your take on it?" And I would assume that the defendants, the human beings, said, "This is why I got insurance. I know that if I'm found responsible, that the verdict would be way more than $1 million. And so please, 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 please pay it." Well, turns out that it was even a little bit more significant than that. After the incident, according to Mr. Itaralde, he said he immediately wanted to go to the hospital and see how Jack was doing. Yet the employer said, insurance company, everybody's saying, "Stay here." So he didn't even leave the jiu-jitsu club because of the instructions of the insurance company, and just continued with business as usual after breaking somebody's neck. And then after that, he said he wanted to reach out to Jack and to talk to him and to see how he's doing and to have conversations about what happened. And the insurance company said, "If you do that, we will pull any coverage for you. You have to defend yourself, and good luck to you." And so for years, he was sitting in silence and having to deal with the issues of what he did to Jack, and then go sit through a trial to talk about what he did to Jack, and then sit through an appeal, and in silence as all of that happened. So there is the other side of this. And when I look at that, I thought, two things. One, this is exactly what the problem is with insurance companies. I know that they're, for the most part, evil profit-making machines that really don't care about human beings. But then to just see it kind of firsthand and see what's going on here in this setting, it just puts full context to the poor decision-making these insurance companies make, and then how they try to turn these poor decisions that they make into saying, what an outrageous outcome. You know, this is just too much money. This is too much anything. Let me spin it and say that Jack is doing a whole lot better than I thought he'd be doing. He's a quadriplegic. His inspiration on Instagram and social media to inspire people is therapy for himself. It doesn't change the fact that he's incontinent. It doesn't change the fact that he's got a scissored gait. It doesn't change the fact that his coordination is grossly diminished and all of the other issues that come with it and the chronic pain and the spasticity and the 7 strokes he went through. I mean, come on. But those are the things that start to bubble up to the top. And nobody really talks about how this insurance company screwed up the lives of so many people by making such a poor decision. And so, you know, that's one of the things. The other thing is, this really highlights in one of our guests, Ricardo Echeverria, he focuses a lot in insurance bad faith. It put into context what I suspected, which was after this verdict, the insurance company had 2 choices. Let's appeal it and post a bond for $70 million. And if we're wrong, we have to pay. Or let's roll the dice and let Mr. Iturralde assign his insurance bad faith rights to the plaintiff and get exposed to an insurance bad faith case, which then could lead to punitive damages and other types of additional remedies over and above the $46 million verdict. And they chose to go the appeal route. And it seems like in large part because the record, it was probably pretty clear that they put Mr. Iturralde in a really bad spot, looking at it in hindsight.
What a story. So when you guys got involved in the case, that was after the $1 million had been demanded and turned down. And at that point, was the case yet in suit? Was it pre-suit? What was the stage when you first got involved?
Oh, yeah, no, the demand was made while it was in litigation. So a lawsuit was filed, defendants and defense counsel appeared, and it was, relatively speaking, the earlier stages of the case. My co-counsel, they're excellent lawyers. And so, you know, everything was moving along perfectly. And then we were working together in lockstep on a going forward basis after that.
I mean, this is in terms of the liability issues, obviously the damages are clear and obvious that they're extreme and any verdict is going to be substantial if you guys win, but it is a challenging liability case. We've done a whole episode on that and a fairly unique fact pattern that there's probably not a lot of precedent where you can look and say, well, this is how a jury's come out in a similar case. So from the just playing devil's advocate on the insurance company side, they're thinking, well, this is a case we can defend potentially. And they're thinking we need to get more, probably would say in retrospect anyway, to justify their conduct. Well, we needed to do some more investigation. We needed to take some, we needed some depositions. We needed some whatever. What point in the way your bad faith law works does it kind of ripen into bad faith? I mean, do you have to give them an opportunity to gather that additional information or how do you define that?
No, that's a great question, Ben. And just to put it into context on this particular case, the policy limit demand was served. They obviously knew what the exposure was on a damages perspective, and they were the keepers. The incident was on video, so they're the keepers and possessed the information as to exactly what happened. They've got multiple black belts that are their clients that they can talk to about what they did and how it happened. So I don't actually believe there was any information that they needed from us in order to appreciate their exposure and to make a good faith or bad faith decision into what they're going to do. But in response, and I think consistent with that, their response to the policy limit demand was not, hey, we have a lot we need to do and consider, and can we get an extension and all that stuff, which would have been not a credible response anyways. But they went straight to the point. They said, hey, we're rejecting the demand because we're going to win a trial. And that gets right to the heart of it, which means that there is a belief that there's going to be exposure. This isn't something that's going to get dismissed on summary judgment. And there's not some dispositive legal issues that are going to end this case that we need to wait and see what happens. But this is going to be up to a jury, and the jury's going to decide it. And we think we're right and you're wrong. Well, that's the exact type of case where, from the insurance company's perspective, they cannot put their interests above those of their insureds. And so when you have the insured saying, hey, pay, 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 and the insurance company saying, yeah, I know there's risk here, and obviously telling them that there's a lot of risk, so that's why we need you to cooperate, but it's our $1 million and we're going to roll the dice, then that's when the burden shifts to the carrier to be responsible for any and all outcomes. And that is a 10,000 foot view, probably overly broad description of insurance bad faith. And then to get into the nitty gritty of it, that's where Ricardo is the man, and somebody who can go deep on all of this, and somebody who I talk to all the time, even on this case.
But you never needed to do the bad faith case here because they just litigated it straight up on the merits all the way through the appeal.
Yes, but yes, through the appeal. So if they went down the other path and decided we're not going to appeal it because we think that we acted in good faith, so we'll just pay you $1 million on the $46 million verdict, go collect against the named defendants, that's when the bad faith case would come about.
Right. And then you were saying there would be damages potentially above and beyond the verdict value for what the emotional coil that they put the jiu-jitsu instructor through as well?
Yes, punitive damages, attorney's fees, all sorts of additional remedies under breach of covenant and good faith and fair dealing and bad faith.
Putting aside the evilness of insurance companies, and we know they don't operate in good faith and their motives are often not pure, but from a pure motive and sensible business standpoint, it would seem logical that they should have paid the money. I mean, just putting aside their evilness, right? I mean, because they're looking down at what's potentially a huge verdict, even if they rank your probability of success fairly low, it's still probably the expected value of that is above the $1 million policy. You guys obviously have a track record of getting enormous verdicts, so you're not a law firm that has demonstrated failure or caving in at the last minute or anything. So it doesn't seem to make a rational sense from a business standpoint either. Do you have any thoughts about why insurance companies continue to make these bad decisions in case after case that, I mean, in this case, turned a $1 million policy into almost $57 million of exposure?
Yeah, I have personal opinions on it. And this is one where the veil hasn't been lifted. If we went down the insurance bad faith route, then I could actually look at the file and say, hey, Ben, here's what actually happened in all of the bad decisions. But I think there's a lot of ego that comes on that side as well. And so we're the big insurance company. That's one of them. Two, and you touched upon it, Ben, there's not a lot of verdicts on assumption of risk type cases, especially things like this. And so it's very possible that there was verbal discussions among lawyers and the insurance adjusters going, I win these cases day in and day out. Of course, there's exposure and risk, but why don't you run it through your tabulator and your statistics machine and see how many times you've actually had to pay the policy limits on an assumption of risk case. So, you know, look like the hero and to save your insurance company $250,000, $500,000. And it's that penny wise, pound foolish. So I'm not exactly sure, other than knowing that this is probably a microcosm of the tens of thousands or millions of claims that are out there. And they do that same nickel and diming decision making. Usually, probably 99% of the cases, it's a low risk proposition. They're off by $5,000. They don't want to be off by $5,000 and they get hit. So be it. But when it comes to some of these, then that's all of a sudden a significant change in their risk tolerance from what they thought versus what they had to pay.
It seems like their algorithm should have a different pathway for PSR cases or any lawyers that have a track record of going to trial and getting big verdicts. It seems like often they don't distinguish. They have a single approach, because the reality is probably most lawyers would have caved at some point. Most lawyers would not have potentially won the case at all or sought it all the way through the appeal or whatever, you know, is required in order to achieve the outcome you did. So in many cases, they probably would have been validated in their decision making, but they don't seem to be able to switch gears based on the facts on the ground.
Well, then also things become unsettleable at some point, right? So part of the reason in serving a policy limits demand is the human component. And a lot of times our clients do not want to go after an individual personally, right? But then also there's a timing part, which is at some point the costs of litigation, because litigation, as we all know, has gotten more and more expensive with every passing month and year, right? And here on a quadriplegia case, with the types of experts that you need to hire and the work that needs to get done, the numbers start to get into the low six figures and then the mid six figures. And as you get close to trial, the high six figures. And I think by the time we were done, we were right around $1 million in out-of-pocket expenses to try this case. The $1 million would net Jack $0 at the end of the day. So it's ultimately a non-offer at some point in time. And the die is cast that the case is going to get tried, or they're paying excess policy limits to resolve it. And they were unwilling to do that.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP, and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
This might be a useful mental exercise in helping to figure out how to position cases, maximum leverage to resolve them. So let's assume, hypothetically, instead of $1 million in coverage, that the defendant in this case had $25 million with a $1 million primary, and then, let's say, four additional layers in a tower, you know, $5 million to $10 million range at each of those additional layers, getting you up to $25 million. Do you think, under those circumstances, there would have been a higher likelihood that the case would have resolved? And how would you use the different leverage and bad faith to position a case like that?
Ooh, that's a great question. Okay.
I'm dealing with that right now in a case. This is why I have a self-interest in understanding what your thoughts are about it.
So. This is, again, reading tea leaves a little bit here, but thinking about the case, yes, it would have a higher likelihood to resolve, but I think the case would have been defended differently too. One of the things that the defense did in this case was they stipulated that the plaintiff was not negligent. And so there was not going to be any comparative fault argument. I believe, and Jack was not negligent, but that's always something that somebody could argue to the jury, right? And so I was always thinking about why the heck did they agree that Jack wasn't negligent? It occurred to me that, well, they've got a $1 million policy, and the only way they prevail on this case is with the defense verdict. Anything else, they're way over policy. And if they're going to blame the white belt for doing something negligently to cause his own harm, they're almost agreeing tacitly that, you know, that the black belt did something wrong too. And so both of them played a role in the case, and then they're going to get hit for something over the $1 million policy. So I think they would have actually defended the case differently, and probably not agreed to waive any comparative fault arguments, and then see where the chips fell. And then that would probably have changed, maybe, I don't know, where the discussions would have gone. I don't know if it would have settled or not, And that really depends on the different layers and how they interacted with each other and how that top layer was going to behave and whether they were going to pay or not pay. Because clearly, I mean, now we get the benefit of hindsight here, but even in this case, we did big data and everything was leading towards a outcome from our perspective in excess of the $25 million hypothetical that you've got. So the ball still would have been in the carrier's court to see if they could resolve it for really probably the policy limits.
In that scenario with the tower, there's some additional pressure on the primary if any of the excess carriers feel differently and feel like they want to limit their own exposure, right? So there's like pressure coming down from the top onto them.
And there are ways, you know, and this is, I'm taking it out of this particular case for a moment, but depending on the nature of the case, I've heard of different ways where demands were made at the different layers. And then that creates a significant tension in between too, as to who's going to be holding the bag on an insurance bad faith case. So there's a lot of different ways and different cases where tension can be created depending on how engaged or disengaged the different layers of the tower are.
The bad faith case fall on whichever layer becomes the obstacle to resolution.
Yeah, and I'll just give an example to that. You know, in that hedge fund case I did in Nevada, there was $27 million in coverage for Marquee, the nightclub, which is part of the Tau group. And then Cosmo had $300 million in additional coverage. But early on, all of the insurance wasn't disclosed. And so certain demands were made based on $27 million in coverage. And then the verdict came and then the case resolved. And then there was litigation for years among the different layers of the carriers saying, you should have paid and you made me pay more and I want my money back. And if you did the right thing a long time earlier, then I wouldn't even have been in this position. So absolutely, the layers all fight among each other, especially in hindsight when somebody's left holding the bag.
So on another topic, Rahul, I mean, when we did the episode on your verdict, you had mentioned at the time that there was initially some backlash from the jiu-jitsu community, felt up in arms about the risks of litigation and assumption of risk issues and so forth. But then potentially, maybe because of Mr. Gracie, your expert.
Yeah, Henner.
Henner Gracie, so the kind of the godfather or founder of this discipline, I think, or some at least a big.
He's in the lineage. Henner's one of the offspring of the Gracie family and a really dynamic and skilled person in the arts of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but also such a fantastic teacher.
But I remember you saying that over time, the kind of community accepted it a little bit more and viewed it more as a cautionary tale and thought, well, maybe we do need to try to change our approach and be a little safer, have some self-policing and standards. I'm kind of curious how that's played out over the years now since the verdict. Have you heard any more about how it's been received and what's happened as a result?
This is all anecdotal, but from all that I've heard and learned, it's clear to me that there is a recognition that dojos and instructors need to be a little more systematic in their safety protocols and making sure that they're teaching and conducting business in a way that looks out for the interests of their students. And what was happening before, with the massive popularity of Brazilian jiu-jitsu and it just growing so fast, anybody with a blue belt or a brown belt could open up a dojo and all of a sudden they just start having jiu-jitsu classes or teaching or training with really no organizational plan. And, you know, what moves are we teaching? What moves are we not teaching? How do we assess the skill of students? And how do we make sure we do pairings properly? Do we have any codes of conduct? A lot of different things that are already out there. And, you know, it's not that hard to learn from, but why take that upon yourself if you don't feel like you have a duty or responsibility to do so? And, you know, you could be that rogue dojo that just takes that and uses that as your branding. And it's clear to me that that sort of mentality of Brazilian jiu-jitsu is just a name and not an art and not something with structure has started to fade away, which is better for students. And the popularity has not diminished a bit. The safety to students and the public in general seems to have increased through this awareness. And that's all positive things. And that goes to the heart of, I think, what we do, Ben, is prevention. And it is always really nice to see when there's impact from a lawsuit that's brought to make sure that hopefully one, two, or thousands of people don't have their necks broken in the future.
You were mentioning this before we went on air, but the ugly side of this is now the insurance company tries to utilize this as a poster child for verdicts run amok and an argument for tort reform, even though all of this was a result of their own bad choices and decision-making and failure to protect their own insured. What are you seeing there, and how, as the trial lawyer community, are we going to combat that approach?
I mean, I think the main thing that really needs to happen and continues to happen is just a full picture about how this industry works. And a lot of times the spotlight, in large part because it's shocking, the insurance industry is a $1 trillion industry, right? The oil industry, massive, whether it's the technology industry, huge. So these corporations that we go against every single day, they're massive. They have the biggest lobbyists on the planet. They're in the air so many different ways to try and protect themselves and not protect the public. And so we're always going to be in an uphill battle as trial lawyers looking out for individuals and trying to make sure that their voices are heard. So when things like this happen, just shining a light on it and hopefully shifting the narrative a little bit, because what kills me is you hear like these things, you know, every plaintiff lawyer is an ambulance chaser. Okay. It doesn't hurt my feelings, but the connotation of it misses the other side of the coin, which is when somebody's gravely injured in the ER, hopped up on all these meds, you know who probably is coming to visit them? A representative of the insurance company for the driver that caused that harm, to get them to sign some sort of document saying, hey, you'll take $15,000 to settle this case in its entirety. And that is a real dark underbelly of the insurance industry, where they go out and do these types of things. And people don't even know their rights, don't even know what's going on, may not even have full coherence based on the medicines that they're on in the ER. Yet the insurance companies go in and try to save their money by taking these righteous cases and righteous claims and settling them for pennies on the dollar. And that happens over and over again. And it's never talked about because the insurance company doesn't put a spotlight on that. And it's really hard for victims to put a spotlight on that.
I mean, if you watch sports as I do, every commercial is for some insurance company. So they're not hurting for money, and they're certainly able to spend tens and tens of millions of dollars on marketing to try to get more customers to pay them premiums. Where they don't like to spend money is on the other side, when their services are actually needed to protect people like Mr. Itiralde. So, I mean, how about inviting Itiralde to come on our show and tell his own story? That would be a way to combat that false narrative.
Well,
and you guys, maybe you guys could become friends.
Highly doubt that.
He's not the guy I'd want as your enemy, Raul, if you meet him in a dark alley.
I highly doubt that we're going to be friends, you know, and looking at his version of the story, there's parts of it where I recognize that the insurance industry put them in a bad spot. But there's other parts of it which I find to be preposterous. So, you know, one of the other comments that he made is, oh man, this is this high stakes litigation. I think the judge had a financial interest in the outcome. Everybody had a financial interest in the outcome. And really the biggest victim of this whole tragedy is me, Mr. Itiralde. that's a real problem. So, you know, and
that doesn't evidence a lot of insight or introspection into the situation.
No, it really doesn't. And
what was his nickname? Sinistro? Or
Sinistro.
Something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
has he given that nickname up, or is
no,
he still going by that?
He now calls it, I think his new dojo is called Sinistro Gentle Arts or something like that.
Gentle Arts. Interesting.
There was just some weird things where he said in a declaration, because I didn't want to make a big deal about it. It didn't really matter to me what his nickname was, but it seemed to matter to him because he filed a declaration saying my nickname's Sinistro because I'm left-handed, and that means left-handed in Portuguese or some other language, right? But everything on all the websites that he puts and everywhere says, you know, Sinistro means sinister. And so why did he lie in a declaration saying that that's my nickname because I'm left-handed, when really Sinistro means what everybody thinks it means? And that was the only moment it was going to come up in trial. And it didn't, because the judge wouldn't even let me go there. So even though it was direct impeachment, the judge was like, no, we're just going to stay away that.
Despite the judge's financial interest in the outcome.
Exactly. I mean, it's just outrageous to even think that. So, yeah, so I don't think Mr. Iturralde is going to make it on here as a guest. I don't think we're ever going to be seeing eye to eye.
Well, Mr. Iturralde, if you're listening, Sinistro, you are invited. Even if Rahul doesn't want you, I want you to come on and tell your story, and you guys can chat it up, find some common ground. As long as there's a nice separation of distance between everybody, so you can't employ the dark arts, of which you're quite skilled, I'm sure. Well, Rahul, it's really an amazing story, and congratulations on seeing it through to the end. How did your client receive the news that he had finally prevailed on all the appeals, and the case was finally done, and he finally was compensated?
He was, the stress of litigation on a client is so immense. And then for clients to have the fortitude to actually make it through a trial, as we all know, that's just a lot. It's a lot to put on somebody, and it's a lot of uncertainty, and it's reliving it day in and day out every single day. And that's something a lot of people don't want to have to relive, the tragedy that they went through and the moments they went through in full color all the time. And then the appeal process and the uncertainty as to, is the verdict going to get taken away? It's a meaningless document unless and until it's final. Am I going to go have to retry this case and live through the stress of another trial and another uncertainty? And how many years later, if I win the case again after retrying it, am I going to be up on appeal again? And then am I going to have to retry it? When is this going to end? Right? And this young man who was 23 when his life changed so dramatically, to then have to go through, you know, half a decade of uncertainty. That is such a relief for Jack, and I'm so happy for him. And in true form, he continues to be the same person he was before the case was finally resolved. And it's not like he's sort of changed his lifestyle into being, you know, what you'd anticipate, but really is continued to focus on his health and his recovery, and trying to be an inspiration for others, in part because being a survivor of a tragedy like this and a sporting accident, he's not alone. There's a lot of others who've suffered that, and a lot of others who are in despair, and he knows that from his firsthand experience, and he continues every single day to try and remind those who've suffered such tragedies that there can be a light at the end of the tunnel, and so don't give up. So I'm a huge, huge Jack Greener fan. I'm so proud of everything that he's done with himself and what he continues to do for the community, and I'm just glad that this chapter is behind him.
Just as he's a model and inspiration for his community, you're a model and inspiration for our community, Rahul.
Oh.
No, you absolutely are. And I think everyone listening to this will take great inspiration from that story. And hopefully can apply some of the lessons and just feel the power and strength of being able to fight for someone like you did and try to achieve this kind of an outcome for another human being and to make hopefully the world a little bit better and a little bit safer. So thank you for everything you've done.
Well, thank you, Ben, and every trial lawyer out there for being a community to lean on, to get advice from, and to support each other, because there's another part of this is being a trial lawyer. It's not easy. It's mentally taxing, sometimes physically taxing, and it can be a tremendous sacrifice, but it's also so, so rewarding and so joyful and so much fun. And there's a lot to accomplish as a trial lawyer, and I love doing it, and I love doing it with you, Ben, and so many of my other friends and colleagues.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.